Radio. Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is August 16th, 2011, and this is episode 521. More about this program and the guests that have provided us with such fascinating conversations can be found on our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. The Dawn of Shades always tries to bring interesting people right to the audience to hear about both new and old ideas. We focus on the people, places, and ideas that don't always make the mainstream news, the kinds of things that are often labeled as alternative or paranormal. For the show tonight, if you would like to have a question asked, you can email me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com or send it through the virtual auditorium on Pal Talk by text. I do monitor the email during the program, so if you're listening outside of the virtual auditorium and would like to have a question answered, go ahead and email it to me and I'll get it asked for you. In the virtual auditorium, just put it into text, and I'll try and catch it as the screen scrolls. And if I don't catch it the first time, feel free to repeat it again. And for those of you who are listening in on a podcast, you can go ahead and email me with your questions as well. I'll try and get them answered for you. And if you want to call in and ask your question on the air, you may call in at 504-273-7379. That number is our call-in number, and once again, it is 504-273-7379. For those of you who'd like to feel connected, you can find me on Facebook and on Twitter, so you can link to me there. There's also a Dawn of Shades fan page, so you can look for that too. For the readers, campers, foodies, etc., check out the articles and blogs. You might find some material that just might interest you. Now tonight, we're fortunate enough to be joined by a man who has written an impressive list of books, and has a lot to say about ancient America, Atlantis, archaeology, and a lot more. I'm very happy tonight to welcome Frank Joseph to the program. Frank, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience?
Well, my name is Frank Joseph. I live in the Upper Mississippi River Valley, about 2 hours' drive from Twin Cities, Minneapolis-St. Paul. And for, I guess, the last 30, going on 40 years now, I have been particularly interested in pre-civilizations. In other words, the civilizations that existed before the well-known civilizations of Egypt or Sumer, and that these civilizations are referred to mostly as mythic, but I found that these myths have greater roots in reality than I ever imagined. And so I traveled around the world for several decades, as a matter of fact, researching these various civilizations, and in the process, I collate for my books, which I'm still writing.
Uh-huh. And it must be quite an exciting thing to do, to travel around and look for the material for your books.
Well, it was. I wouldn't be able to do it today. The world situation has deteriorated to such an extent, there's no way that I could have the freedom to access the numerous places that I went to. Many of the places that I went and did my investigations have completely erupted into chaos, and it's and the security that's involved and so on. It would be utterly impossible to reproduce my travels that I did in the 80s and the early 90s.
Yeah. Well, I think about, you know, even Mexico, which most Americans regard as a fairly safe country to visit. I remember, this is close to 10 years ago now, but a friend and I were going to take a vacation together, and we both were wanting to do something a little adventurous. So we were going to take a train trip into Mexico that took you into Gold Canyon. And it sounded like a wonderful trip. So somebody else says, you know, that train gets robbed every week. Sure enough, when we checked out, it did get robbed every week with real bandits with real machine guns. And I told her, I said, you know, we want adventure, but I want it canned. You know, I really don't want real bullets. And I said, no, I can't do that. Yeah, so I have
absolutely
to say,
too, about the trains being very dangerous. They always have been. And I did have a situation like that. I took the train from Mexico City to Merida in Yucatan. And, yeah, we had quite an adventurous time. That would take up an entirely different show. But Mexico has always been a dangerous place. It's always been dangerous. Even before the Spaniards arrived, it was a very dangerous place. It's rough. But now, I would say it just is impossible. That's why so much field work, and even mainstream archaeologists, are not able to continue with their research because it's just too dangerous. You have to hire your own army just about. You can't even trust them after you've hired them, so it's very rough. So I'm very grateful that I was able to complete most of my research before conditions became too impossible.
Yeah, I mean, even Egypt, you know, we're seeing that their society is breaking down right now, and you know, who knows there, ultimately. The Middle East is rather a hot spot. I don't think I'd want to take a vacation there.
It's rough, but the thing about it was that the reason why I began these travels was not just for kicks. You can only read so much about a place like Atlantis or Lemuria without checking up on the sources where this information really came from, going to the places that were supposedly directly affected by these previous civilizations and talking to the native people about their traditions of these places. And once you've begun to travel like that and actually access these places and stand where this prehistory took place, it sort of, it can change one's life and certainly changes one's outlook. And I began as a complete skeptic in both of these civilizations that I mentioned, for example, Atlantis and Lemuria. And after years of traveling and seeing these places firsthand and seeing the ruins and talking to the people that are there, I have no doubt that these places existed. They existed just as surely as Rome or Greece existed. The difficulty is, of course, is that they were much older, great natural catastrophes, and so not that much is left. But enough is left. There's enough information left that I'm sure that if I was in a court of law, I would bring in a guilty verdict on their previous existence if I could argue my case. And that's what my books are about.
Uh-huh. Well, out of all the places that you visited, what one place probably had the most profound effect on you?
It's impossible to say, but I can think of, because many did, but I can think of one offhand. It's rather obvious, I think, to people, and that is the Great Pyramid of Egypt. Before you go to a place, I found, you develop a picture in your mind, expectations, and then when you finally go to the place that you've been thinking about and reading about, yet either it disappoints you, it's not as great as you thought, and there are some places that are pretty much the way you expected, and then there are others that are far greater than you ever imagined. I've been sort of obsessed with the Great Pyramid since I was a boy, and it seems like about 500 years ago at this point. But I was really always very much interested in Egypt and especially the Great Pyramid. So I read everything I could for many, many years. And then when I finally stood in front of the Great Pyramid of Egypt, it blew everything out of the water. It is a far greater personal experience, and that many people find this. This is a common experience, which I share with millions of people, I suppose. But it really is. I mean, that is, when you stand in front of structure, you know that this is the foremost building on earth. And the more you learn about it, it becomes even greater. But you don't have to know anything about it. You have to know nothing about it. Just to stand in front of that incredible edifice. It's more than just stone. There is some tremendous energy of some kind. That has a real presence. It's this an incredible experience. It's certainly a life-changing experience, I would say. Definitely in my case, I don't think too many people go to the Great Pyramid and are disappointed. If they are, they lack all sense of imagination.
Yeah, I would say the Great Pyramids would probably be a pretty profound experience. Was there a place that you found disappointing?
I really can't think so. I mean, even those places that may have disappointed me at first, later on, in retrospect, they seem to assume greater significance. I can't think of any place I ever went that I found really disappointing. It's, you know, the thing is that these sites around the world, so-called historical sites, the one thing that really impressed me about them all, whether it's Troy or the Great Pyramid or Stonehenge or any of these places, the thing that impressed me is that if it wasn't for the spiritual aspects of these structures or these places, they would be really just nothing but earth or stone. They would just be inanimate things. Mm-hmm. They are great because there is some human impact on them, that they still resonate with something. And that really is the big revelation I had. Because when I began traveling, I was a stone atheist. I was even worse than an atheist. I was a kind of a nihilist. I didn't believe in anything at all. I believed in nothing. I was interested in archaeology, but I didn't believe in the human soul or wasn't interested in any of that nonsense. But those years of traveling convinced me otherwise, that something like the Great Pyramid would be just a pile of rocks, right? Stone, certainly well engineered, unless there was something at its core which still resonates, and that I found to be a common denominator for all the places that I visited, that they have a presence about them, have a personality, and if you open yourself to it, all these places speak to you. They will all speak to you. Even the most mysterious of them all, the ones you cannot figure out at all why this was made or how this came to be, if you know how to listen, they all are speaking to you.
Now, you know, and all the different sites across the world that are available for people to take a look at some point in the last two decades, maybe they're not currently available, but was there a place that you never got to see that you that was on your list of I want to see this?
Yeah, there are still a few. I have never yet been to Easter Island, for example. I've always wanted to go there. And the best way to see Easter Island is you can rent a horse, I understand. And you can. That's the best way to see the Moai or the great structures that are on Easter Island. So I've never made it to Easter Island. There are places in China which you can't get to. I'd like to go. There are some fabulous pyramids, ancient pyramids in China which few people know about, that the government doesn't want people to see, so there's no way I could see that. I've also never been to Nan Madol, which is one of the most incredible places on Earth. Nan Madol is this very small island, very small, off the coast of another small island called Planas. It's the most remote place you can imagine. I think the nearest landfall is like 2,300 miles away. It's just totally remote. And off the coast of Panop is Nan Madol, which is a man-made island. The whole island is man-made. And on this island are these incredible stone towers. It is a stone city made entirely out of magnetized basalt. Basalt is a volcanically extruded rock. And originally some of these towers were as high as 60 feet. The tallest one today is a little over 20 feet. It was made no one knows how long ago, no doubt thousands of years ago. There's all kinds of problems in, as regarding its testing of its trying to get its date. And it is an incredible place. It's made up of not only stone towers, but also what they call fish weirs or fish factories. It's not primitive at all. It's rather crude, but not primitive. It's well made. And it is comprised of about 2,800 tons of magnetized basalt. Who made this? To what purpose? Nobody knows.
Where did you get the rock from?
Pardon me?
Where did the rock come from?
The basalt?
Uh-huh.
It was originally thought that the basalt comes from the other side of the island of Panop. It turns out that the quarries on Panop have never been large enough to supply all of the salt. So that's an unanswered question. Where did these 2 billion tons of magnetized basalt, In other words, if you go to Nam Ngul and you bring your compass along, you'll see two strange things because the basalt is magnetized. It's a very bizarre place. Now, the only traditions are amongst some of the local Macronesians who talk about these two brothers who sailed across the sea, and they were these magicians. This is their mythology speaking, of course. And these magicians had sailed from the loss of their homeland, which had been destroyed by a natural catastrophe, a great flood, and that they settled on they made this island, Nan Madol, which means the spaces in between in Macronesian. The spaces in between. It refers to the foundations for these structures. Oh, they created this huge wall, a stone wall, which is about a mile and a quarter long, still exists. Some of these stones have been found nearby underwater, which gives you an indication. If this structure was made, this city was made, at the time that the sea was low enough to accommodate these structures, then we're talking about at least 3,000 to 5,000 years ago, probably much longer ago than that, because that's when we know that the sea levels were much lower than they are now. That's an incredible site. I've never been there. Because it's very expensive to get there, and I've just never had the wherewithal to get there, unfortunately.
And not only expensive, but I suspect they don't exactly have an international airport either, do they?
No, they don't. As a matter of fact, that's another good point. As a matter of fact, there are no regular flights there. There's no anchorage there. I think that you have to hire chartered flights out of Tahiti or something, and that's very costly. And it only once you're there, you're going to be stuck there for at least 2 weeks. And the amenities there are zero. A little town there, the local people are not all that friendly, I'm led to believe, anyway. So it'd be a rough stay.
Being on an isolated island with people that are unfriendly to outside.
And there's no medical facilities, nothing like that at all.
This doesn't sound like that.
It'd be rough. I have been in worse places, let me tell you. I've been chased out of a lot of places, so I'd be kind of used to that, I suppose. I know what it's like to run for your life, let me tell you. When I was in Morocco, I was at the top of the Kasbah, which was in... not Casablanca, that was Marrakesh, I guess it was. And I was chased by a mob of people who thought I was an infidel, worthy of a tormented death, apparently.
That's everybody's idea of a good time, right?
Well, I didn't plan it that way. I promise you, it just worked out that way. And I've been chased out of a lot of places. But I'm too old for that now, so I just write about them.
I have
to say. But Nan Ngul, I mean, I don't want to just leave hang. I mean, most people have never heard of Nan Ngul, but now.
I've never heard of it.
What is this place, you know? So I did a lot of research. I knew people who went there, luckily. I got a chance people who could tell me what it was like. And people that worked there full-time for the American Embassy and so on. I got some great photographs of the place. So I feel I know it almost as much as I was there. Close as I can, and you know, for the sake of brevity on this show, because we don't have all that much time, Nan Ngul, this great mystery, which nobody can figure out who made it, when they made it, or why. It resembles nothing else in the world except one other site, which is 300 miles away, another extremely remote little island called Khos Rey. And on Khos Rey, there's the same type of architecture, only much smaller. Same magnetized basalt, only much smaller and more ruinous. Those are the only two places on Earth that are like this. I figure, what on Earth is this? What could this be? Well, in a nutshell, what it is, and this is really rough to accept, except that I have run this hypothesis past some pretty good geophysicists who concurred with my conclusion. And my conclusion is that this site called Nan Ngul, this huge collection of magnetized basalt, is part of a weather modification device. Yeah, the weather modification device. And it was made by people who no longer exist, who possess a technology which we are able to understand but have not yet made. And this weather modification device is proved by the fact, or at least argued persuasively, I think, by the fact that Nanmadol sits right in the middle of what is known as a typhoon factory. And it's in an area of the world in which the cold air at a certain time of the year hits the warm surface of the water and creates typhoons. That's how they're caused. And Nanmadol, when it was in its height, when it was operative, when it wasn't the ruin that it is today, it's being ruined primarily by the jungle taking over, tearing it down. And this huge collection of magnetized basalt would have interfaced with the beginnings of a typhoon, which would have degaussed it. In other words, it would have taken the electrical component out of a typhoon and stopped the typhoon from becoming a severe storm. That's the only place in the world where it would have worked. Well, why would anybody want to stop a typhoon out in the middle of nowhere, right? Typhoons that begin right at Nanmadol, and they still begin there today.
Uh-huh.
They become great, powerful storms that slam into the Philippines, especially a place called Luzon. And on Luzon is another fabulous site and a direct line from Nanmadol, only maybe about another 400 or 500 miles away. It's about 1,000 miles away, I guess. On Luzon is another huge site, also unknown to most people. It's called the Banawe Rice Fields. The Banawe Rice Fields are the largest food factory ever made on Earth. It's huge. It's an entire valley, a mountain valley, that was terraformed. In other words, was changed and altered and landscaped by hand at least 2,000 years ago, almost certainly longer ago than that, by another totally unknown people. And the productivity of these rice fields, these terraced fields, they did a lot more than rice, by the way, was phenomenal. It would have been able to feed millions of people. Now, who in the Philippines would have needed food productivity by the millions, because we're told by archaeologists there were only maybe a few thousand people in the Philippines 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. And yet this huge food factory was capable of producing enormous produce. It's right on a straight line with Nanmadol. So, if you've got a great food factory going, you can't have it ravaged by typhoons every once in a while, so you create a weather-altering place. And that's what the same people who made the Banawe rice fields are the same people that made Nanmadol. It's part of an enormous, huge civilization that existed thousands of years ago. It no longer exists, and we are looking at the ruins of this civilization. I put that together in my book called The Lost Civilization of Lemuria. That is how it is remembered in the traditions of people from Tibet all the way across Polynesia and into South America. They refer to it as Mu, Lemuria, Lemu, cultural inflections on the same theme, the same place. So it's an extremely exciting thing. I mean, to think that Americans think that, you know, we have the greatest civilization ever existed and all this, but believe me, other civilizations have come and gone, and Lemuria was among the most outstanding of them all. And their food factory still exists at the Banawe Rice Fields in Luzon, the Philippines. And you can still go to Nanmadol and see this incredible ruin. That's the only plausible explanation for Nanmadol, that it is an interface of meteorological phenomena. I know it's an incredible thing to some. I've explained it in greater detail in my book than I can here, of course.
Right.
I presented this before a symposium, as a matter of fact, about 3 years ago, at the Ancient American Artifact Preservation Society, and Professor Hoover was there. He's professor emeritus from University of Texas, I believe, in Dallas. And he said, yeah, it's pretty fantastic stuff, he says, but it makes a great deal of sense. And he said such a thing would have worked. A weather modification device would have worked. So,
interesting. Yeah. And what would be what is your idea of the approximate location
of this Lemuria that no longer exists? Where was it? In its heyday, where would it have been, in, you know, more or less?
Lemuria was less a place than it was a culture and a people spread over many places. And many of the islands that they occupied still exist. Some do not. They suffer the same type of natural catastrophes that we suffer today, especially in the Pacific, known as the Ring of Fire. Of course, you have tsunamis, like in Indonesia and in Japan more recently. These people had the same difficulties. So they experienced some catastrophic natural phenomena, no doubt tsunami type of disasters, that eventually wiped out their island base, as it were. But the islands themselves that were occupied by the Lemurians still exist in Nan Madol and certainly in the Philippines. This is another thing that we're not taught in our schools, that Polynesia, the almost thousands and thousands of Polynesian, Macronesian, Micronesian islands are covered with ancient, mysterious ruins which no archaeologist can explain, because these ruins often predate the earliest known human habitations there. There are even islands completely uninhabited that have never been inhabited, so far as archaeologists know, that have gaunt ruins, beautiful stone ruins. And that there's an island, for example, called Malden, M-A-L-D-E-N, also extremely remote in the northern Central Pacific. And it is encircled by a stone road, an elegantly made stone road. And the stone road leads to small temple platforms, kind of pyramidal-like. And then the road on its south east end vanishes into the sea. It goes straight into the sea. Archaeologists are at a total loss to explain who made this structure, how old it is. Very old. For the road to disappear into the sea, it means the sea levels were much lower long ago. And there are ruins like this throughout Polynesia. And if you go to the local people and ask them who made these, almost invariably they say the same thing. They do not claim that their ancestors made these structures. And it would be very great for them to make such a claim, because some of these structures are incredibly impressive. They say the same thing. Always a previous people who suffered a natural catastrophe, and that this was part of their previous civilization at one time, and that they were highly advanced technologically and spiritually. They were masters of the conscious and the subconscious mind. This is a common denominator you find everywhere throughout Polynesia, from the Japanese islands all the way to South America.
I do have to ask at this point, though, you know, they were supposed to have this greater consciousness and this greater spirituality, but yet their civilization is gone. I mean, what kind of lesson is that for us today?
The lesson is that we're going to go too. Everything lives and dies. It is the process of life here, the natural process of life. You're born, you prosper, you mature, you decline, and you die. That is true of individuals and whole societies. Nothing lasts forever. The story of the universe is that nothing is deleted, but everything is always changed. Change is the common denominator of the cosmos and our lives here. The Lemurians actually, after they lost their civilization, they did not die out completely. They made a fantastic impact on the cultures and especially the spiritual disciplines of the Near East and the Far East, which we still benefit from today. The most direct Lemurian connection is with Tibetan Buddhism. And Tibetan Buddhism is roaring back these days and making a fantastic impact on the outside world, even in the Western world. The roots of Tibetan Buddhism are in their own Tibetan religion, previous Buddhist religion, called the Burn religion. Sometimes it's called the Bon religion, it's badly pronounced Burn. The Burn religion is incredibly Lemurian in its stories and its spirituality. The Lemurians reached very high levels of spiritual potency. And they passed a lot of this on to the peoples that they went to after, as survivors after the final destruction of their society. Their society lasted a very long time. A very long time. The end date is pretty sure. The end date would appear to be somewhere around the early 17th century B.C. In other words, about 1628 B.C. We know that because there was a global catastrophe that took place at that time.
Uh-huh.
And this global catastrophe had a profound impact, especially in the Pacific. And Lemuria appears to have been unable to have survived, which was really a series of natural catastrophes, when a comet known as Comet Encke, was named after Rudolf Encke, a Swiss astronomer, who found it, I think, around 1800. And this comet still exists today, but it's only just a pale ghost of what it once was. Every time a comet goes around the sun, it loses more of its matter. But 3,700 years ago, 3,600 years ago, it was a powerful phenomena which rained down a barrage of meteoric material that affected the northern hemisphere and especially the Pacific, and this was apparently too much for the Lemurians to withstand. However, their society went back tens of thousands of years, a very long time, and they slowly developed over time this wonderful relationship with nature, which is still enshrined in some of the mythological beliefs of the peoples that consider themselves the indirect descendants of the Lemurians, and also especially the impact that's been preserved so fantastically well in Tibetan Buddhism especially, although there are elements in Hinduism and even in bits of Confucianism, which is also based on these early traditions. But most specifically, if you want to know about Lemurians, you can study the origins of Tibetan Buddhism, and they begin to appear.
Well, that's quite interesting.
Yeah, you look at these bits and pieces, and you have, even in the United States, you visit the ones, and you know from the archaeologists who originally had investigated the ruins, often they found food and pottery and personal items that were literally just left in, like the people just walked away one day, come back.
And you find out
where'd they go? Why?
Well,
you know,
obviously
food
there
and
was
shelter
there
was pretty tough to get.
There were obviously something happened that made them want to leave right away, where they didn't have time to take their goods with them, and this is part of this natural catastrophe. It's the process of nature, these tsunamis that have taken place, and the close calls with comets and meteors. You know, the dinosaurs now are thoroughly understood to have been liquidated by a massive asteroid collision that took place off the coast of Yucatan. And extinctions are part of the process of life here.
Yeah, this is true. Now, I do have a question from the virtual auditorium. It's sort of off on a bit of a tangent from where we were talking. But the question is, what do you think of the Great Hopewell Road symbolized as described on pages 89 and 90 of your Advanced Civilizations of Prehistoric America? These straight roads in Ohio have been brought from South America.
Well, that's a really interesting point. I was completely unaware of these massive highways that were built in prehistoric times. We think that we have, this great highway system. We do. America has a fabulous highway system, the interstate that connects all the states together, but it wasn't the first. And the person who asked this question is referring to something called the Great Hopewell Road. And
uh-huh.
It's a beautiful road that was made about 2,000 years ago. The reason we call it Hopewell, H-O-P-E-W-E-L-L, is an archaeological term, and it refers to an otherwise unknown people who flourished in North America, specifically in the Midwest, from about 200 B.C. to 400 A.D. We don't know what these people called themselves. They were a high culture. They were civilized people. They did incredibly beautiful effigy mounds. An effigy mound is a landscape mound in the shape of an animal or a geometric figure. And they did tens of thousands of these. They were also great workers in copper and so on. But the Hopewell people, that's what archaeologists call them because it was named after a farmer, Mr. Hopewell, in Ohio, where they found some of these early mounds. And the Hopewell culture was also responsible for this beautiful road, and it wasn't just a crude ditch. Yeah. It was a combination of actual construction materials. Other roads, ancient roads, have been found in West Virginia, and they extend sometimes for 60 or 100 miles. They're broad, they go in a straight line, and they were probably used for ceremonial reasons. So you had great masses of people in fabulous ceremonies and rituals who would use these roads to go from sacred site to another. And it's a tremendous achievement. You see also the same road-building technique in the American Southwest. There was a culture there called the Anasazi. And the Anasazi, who were much later than the Hopewell, they were different than the Hopewell, the Anasazi built roads that were surveyed with incredible mathematical precision. Astounding. And that these roads that spanned altogether thousands of miles, if you can believe that, altogether, you put all the roads together, it'd be thousands of miles long, were oriented to the appearance of the sun at specific times and the moon, mostly the sun. They were aligned with astronomical phenomena. The Anasazi had were allied with a very close people called the Hohokam. I don't want to lay too much of this on you.
Mm-hmm.
But the Hohokam were a little different than the Anasazi. They didn't build roads so much as they built massive irrigation works, professional irrigation works with sluice gates and just magnificently modern works of art. And if you took all of the irrigation works, the canals, some of them were cement, and you put all the canals end to end, they would form a single canal that would extend from Phoenix, Arizona, to beyond the Canadian border. And this is a pre-industrial people, about 1,000 years ago, who did this. I mean, we are preceded by very great people. The question is, as you raise, you know, what happened to these people? Why aren't they here? How did they lose their civilization? They became very powerful at one time, and their civilization lasted for hundreds and hundreds of years. That is the question that all of these civilizations make us ask. And it's a frightening question, because why do we think we have a special license on longevity? These other civilizations came and went. Why?
Well, you know, we're all quite aware of the main ending in 2012. We've seen many, many. The end of the world is coming. Sort of prophecies from all sorts of people. The end of the world has been coming at least once a decade for hundreds of years, maybe thousands even. You know, so at the same time, it's not that inconceivable to most of us. And then when you add in the turmoil that we're seeing in the world today, you know, people are going, yeah, maybe so. You know, have we reached the natural end of the lifetime of the civilization that we have grown to love and adore and appreciate, you know, like running water and electricity and so forth? You know, who knows?
Well, the world has ended many times for these other cultures. You mentioned the Maya.
Right.
The
right.
world of the Maya ended. It collapsed. Their world did end. And these other civilizations, we're talking about the Anasazi, the Hohokam, the Hopewell, their civilizations ended. Their world ended. did we think that we're any different than these other high civilizations which achieved great things and left just now ruins? Their world ended.
Well, we saw it in Mesopotamia. We've seen it in Egypt. Romans, the Greeks, the Inca. I mean, we can just list.
And they're not with us anymore.
No, they're gone.
They're no longer here. Well, this is the great reason why history needs to be understood. Because in understanding why these civilizations came to an end, perhaps we can see something in ourselves. This is the mistake that Americans continue to make. They are not interested in history for the most part. And they don't like to draw parallels with other cultures. We're different. We have atomic bombs and refrigerators, so we don't have any association with these other past civilizations. That's a mistake, because there are common denominators. We're human beings just the same as the Incas or the Hopewell were. And if they made a mistake, and they obviously made a very bad mistake, to have lost their civilization, they didn't do it voluntarily. They thought they'd go on forever. Then we should draw parallels with ourselves. What are we doing? What is it in our society, which is to other societies? And are we going to lose ours? And if so, how can we avoid that? That's the whole...
I know in discussions I've had with people in the past, the general consensus is other cultures crashed, usually because it reached a society, became degenerate in terms of its politics and in terms of its religion, and is essentially self-destructive. Whether it was because it allowed an outsider to invade them and take over, or whatever, it was a degenerate state. And I look at their politics of today, and I went, ooh, you know, it's a little closer.
That's correct. In a general sense, that's correct. We know, for example, why some of these civilizations were destroyed. We know exactly, for example, what happened to the Anasazi civilization. The Anasazi built a paradise in the middle of the desert. I mean, the Four Corners area of the Southwest is as uninhabitable today as it's always been. It's pretty awful. And yet these people created this incredibly successful, prosperous civilization that flourished for almost 200 years, just like our civilization is. American civilization has prospered for a little more than 200 years, and the same with them. What happened with the Anasazi, though, is that they placed all of their wealth on water. Water was the, of course, in an area like that, was the lifeblood of their civilization. And so long as they were great water managers, and they were, these Anasazi and the Hohokam, their allied people, were masters of water management, and that's what made their society flourish and become huge and prosperous. And then around 1300 A.D. was something known as the Little Ice Age, in which a massive drought overtook that area of the world. As a matter of fact, all the northern hemisphere was affected by it, and the water became scarcer and scarcer. So here was a civilization which placed most of its wealth, most of its power, on the abundance and the control of water. When that was no longer available, when the water became so scarce that not everybody could have it anymore, you had social dislocation. The society began to unravel. You had massive rioting that took place. Cities were overthrown, became uninhabitable. The ruling class, the Anasazi, left Chaco Canyon, which was their great place of their sacred center and their ceremonial center. They left. They abandoned it to the mobs that overtook it. Lived in gated communities. How about that? They lived up now in, I don't know, the cliff dwellers, right? You've probably heard about them. That's where the Anasazi, the elite movers and shakers of their society, went, and they were followed by the mobs. And that society degenerated into riots and cannibalism. Cannibalism. The Anasazi ended by being eaten, by being ritually killed and cannibalized, and that was the end of their civilization. Our society, what do we depend on? Not water so much as oil. another liquid. And what happens when that's going to be no longer available or not as easily manipulated? You're going to have the same type of social dislocation that afflicted the Anasazi 1,000 years ago. Their society dissolved into the same kind of chaos that we're seeing all over the world today. Same thing. And unless the people can draw that kind of a parallel, our society will go the same way as the Anasazi. Now, I don't know whether it would be cannibalized or not. Maybe, who knows? But that's what implodes a society. That's what, it's greed. That's primarily the number one. When a people no longer respect those that brought them into existence, when the only thing they think about is self-indulgence, that is generally the death knell of a civilization. Sometimes it's not that. Sometimes it is a natural catastrophe. The Lemurians, there's nothing to indicate that Lemurians ever went through a period of degeneracy. Their society just lasted a long time, and it suffered a natural catastrophe. And its people left and enriched other peoples in the area, from all the way from Asia to South America. And that's not what happened to the Anasazi, though. They did not suffer a natural catastrophe, unless you want to think of the mini ice age in the 14th century that brought about that loss of their water control.
Well, a long-term drought, in a sense, that is a catastrophe. I mean, we're looking at the same sort of long-term drought situation in roughly the same Four Corners area today.
Mm-hmm. But it's primarily is the when you have a people that set themselves, when the ruling class, as it were, the power freaks, become so self-absorbed, they become detached from the, that they're supposedly serving, that's when you have real difficulties. And that's what happened to the Anasazi. They became power freaks. Maybe they always were power freaks, but at least they were successful in the first 150, 175 years of their experiment.
Well, you're talking about Rome there, too, you know, with power freaks and so forth and so on, you know.
It's sad. You know, I think what happened with Rome, it's more of a tragedy because the Romans never set out to make an empire. The Romans, even at the height of their empire, were... You have to understand that Rome had an empire to defend itself against the Germanic barbarians. If the Rome did not have an empire, especially in Europe, the barbarians would have, and as they did, eventually sack Rome and destroy Rome physically. So Rome's empire was absolutely necessary to push back the borders to keep these dangerous peoples away from Rome. Rome is trying to create a civilization in the Italian peninsula. So the Roman Empire makes a lot more sense, and it just got too big. It got unmanageable, too much for any one man, and, of course, then they had two emperors simultaneously. That, of course, led to an impossible situation. So Rome was kind of a victim of its growth. It was constantly threatened by these outside forces. In Europe, it was the Germanic tribes, the savage Teutonic tribes that always wanted to sack Rome. And then, of course, you had other groups of people like the Parthians, very dangerous peoples in the Near East. So Rome became unmanageable. And yes, Rome, unfortunately, did degenerate. So long as Rome was still had the core of its early values, it could withstand these outside pressures. It was always constantly at war. But when Rome became, again, too self-indulgent, and societies, I find, decay from the top down, not from the bottom up. The bottom up is the working people, the working class people. They don't degenerate first. They are usually the last to be poisoned, as it were, infected by the overall decline that sets in at the top. And that's what happened with Rome also. She still could produce some good, but the level of self-indulgence, of course, got to be pretty
big. Yeah, and you start thinking about the American equivalent of the royal family, which is typically regarded as Hollywood, and
yeah,
their shenanigans, and you kind of go, ooh, you're drawing way too many parallels there.
Yeah, it's a shame because people that, like in Hollywood, for example, the actors and actresses there, they are so popular, and they could be such a great force for good by setting good examples for, especially for young people. And they of course they do not set good examples. They set very bad examples, and this has a trickle down effect. Because if you admire someone like, well, I won't mention anybody by name, but some particular actor or actress, and you find them very appealing in every way, and then you find out that they are doing some rather despicable things, it's sort of like, well, so who cares then? I can do anything, you know.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened with these other societies. They let themselves become overwhelmed by greed, and I think that's what's happening here. It's the same cycle. There was a very great philosopher, historian by the name of Oswald Spengler at the beginning of the 20th century. He wrote a book called The Decline of the West, and in this he cited 8 previous civilizations that went through the process that I mentioned of birth, growth, maturity, decline, and death. And they all went through the same cycle. He said that the West is also involved in the same cycle. We are now involved in decline, and we'll continue to decline until we kill ourselves off as well. I don't necessarily believe that those cycles exist. Of course, they do exist. But it's not inevitable that ours will terminate this way, hopefully.
I think perhaps the situation today may be a little bit different because of the more global nature of society and civilization. To see a collapse of civilizations today means a huge portion of the world is going to.
Well, sure, because they've been talking about the global society for so long, so now we are not immune economically or politically from what happens in other parts of the world. But so they're really, fundamentally, really nothing has changed at all. It's just bigger, that's all. I mean, it's instead of being just one society called the whole world.
At risk, but it's going to have a more, collapse today will have a more profound effect on humanity than I think any previous civilization's collapse ever had.
I don't know. The collapse of Rome was pretty thorough. But the sad thing about it is that these previous civilizations that offer, I think, especially spiritually, they had some, like the Lemurians that we were mentioning, these were people who, for all intents and everything I've been able to learn about the Lemurians, that they were not a militaristic people, that they had a national ethic. This is one thing I learned when I was traveling. I found that every people in the world has a kind of national ethic. The national ethic, for example, of the Tibetans today is not success in the term that we understand, personal success. The thing that people, the Tibetans, strive for is the development of their soul to the point that after they die, they're not reincarnated, that their soul is liberated from samsara or the cycles of birth, death, and rebirth. And this is the thing that motivates the average Tibetan. And then you go to a place like Japan, for example, and the national ethic there is social cooperation. That you're decent to your fellow human beings, and they're decent to you. This, of course, isn't universal to the extent that it's absolutely ever, but generally you find that the Japanese behave in a very civilized manner because this is their national ethic. And the Lemurians...
Hang on to that thought right there, because, folks, it's time for us to take a break. So while we're on the computer, check out our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. You can also take a look at www.markshsites.web.com, and there's some photographs of the Hopewell Road that have been put up there. Stay tuned in the Dawn of Shades. We'll return with our guest, Frank Joseph, and more fantastic conversation in just a few minutes.
Remembering what she said. Ah, here I am on the road again. There I am up on the stage. Here I go playing the star again. There I go. Turn the page.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, with our guest, Frank Joseph. And once again, I would like to remind everyone to visit our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. You want to wander around, explore the website, let me know what you think of it. You can find links to take you to blogs, Twitter, Facebook, and if you want to go straight to the blog, you can go to gscott.wordpress.com and you can find out what kinds of things I've been up to lately. Now, our topic tonight is really a fascinating one, and we're fortunate enough to have the author, Frank Joseph, joining us tonight. So if you would like to ask him a question, you can email it to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com, and I'll pass it on from there. If you're listening in on a podcast or think of it after the program is finished, go ahead and email it to me. I'll do my best to get your questions answered for you. If you're in the virtual auditorium, put it in the text there, and I'm trying very hard to catch it as the screen scrolls. And if you want to call in and ask on the your question on the air, you can call 504-273-7379. Now, Frank, we were talking a little bit while we were on break, but I had recently been sent an article that you had written, and unfortunately it was missing the middle. So I'm dying to know. Tell us a little bit about that early hot air balloon from South America.
Well, this is, I think, very interesting. The article that you're referring to appears in a magazine that I write for called Ancient American. And it comes out, it's a quarterly, it just comes out four times a year. And in the most recent issue of Ancient, there is an article I've written called Ancient Aviators of the Andes. And it is in regards to a man who had the first successful flight in history. Now, we think, of course, first of the Wright brothers. They had their aircraft in 1903. And then before them were the Montgolfier brothers, who were in the late 18th century. They flew their balloon, the hot air balloon, the tethered balloon. But in fact, these men were not the first to achieve manned flight, historic manned flight. There was a priest, his name was Guzmán, and he was from Brazil. And about 50 years before the Montgolfier brothers had their tethered balloon flight, first balloon flight, Guzmán went to Lisbon, and there he launched the very first successful free balloon flight in history. He was the first person to actually fly in a man-made craft, and this is thoroughly documented. It is known to aviation historians, but has not leaked out to the majority of people who teach history in the schools. But Guzmán made his first flight about 1750. I don't have the date in front of me. My little noodle of a brain can't remember all of this stuff. But it was around 1750 that Guzmán, Father Guzmán, piloted hot air balloon and flew about a mile and a half. And what's interesting about Guzmán is that as a young man and a young priest, he was sent, he's originally Portuguese, he was originally sent to Brazil to become a missionary. And while he was proselytizing Christianity to the natives of Brazil, he was surprised to learn from the natives that they knew about manned flight of their ancestors, or people long even before their ancestors, and that the natives of Brazil and Venezuela to this day, these are native Indian tribes, tribal peoples who live deep in the jungles of Brazil and Venezuela, create aerostats. An aerostat is kind of like a model hot air balloon. And what they do is they have little light ceramic cups in which they light oil fires, little fire, and they create a kind of an envelope, and they float these through the air, these hot air balloons. Claim that this is a technology which they inherited from their ancestors and from before their ancestors by a people known as the Contiki Viracochas. Contiki Viracochas refer to a royal family. The name literally in English means sea foam. and it refers to the bow wave of the ship that brought the Contiki Viracochas to the shores of South America, and they brought with them an advanced technology. Interestingly enough, when Guzmán's great achievement in 1750, the first flight, became known to a fellow by the name of Jim Woodman back in the 1970s, he felt that possibly the creators of the great civilizations in South America and Peru and Chile may have had access to manned flight. After all, if the natives knew about this technique, which Guzmán later, of course, developed into the first hot air balloon, that perhaps this would explain some of the features of ancient South American civilization. And one of those outstanding features, the Nazca Lines. The Nazca Lines refer to an area known as the Nazca Desert. It's the driest area in the world, has the least rainfall on Earth, and it's along the Pacific coast of Peru. And in this desert are found about a 100 drawings, illustrations in the sand. It is the largest art gallery on Earth. Some of these drawings span miles long. They represent anything from whales to spiders to birds to geometric forms to straight lines. Some of the lines go on for, originally they don't know how long they went on. They went on for several miles long, perfectly straight lines. Others are zigzags that are maybe about 2 miles long. So the one of the spider, beautifully done execution of a spider, is about 80 feet long. They have one that appears to be of a human being. Actually, it's a composite figure. It's an anthropomorphic owl. That's about 100 feet long. I've seen them. When I visited Peru, I was fortunate enough to be able to rent an aircraft, and they will fly you around. You can see them. They can only be seen properly from altitude. On the ground, they just seem like straight lines. Matter of fact, they were only found for the first time in 1932 by a pilot who happened to fly over the Nazca Desert, looked down from the altitude of about 3,000 feet, and was astounded to see this great art gallery stretched for miles and miles below him. It had been unknown before. So it's speculated by Jim Woodman, after he learned about Guzmán's flight, that perhaps the Incas or pre-Inca people possessed manned flight. And so he recreated Guzmán's hot air balloon, which was actually based on the native balloons, these aerostats as they're referred to. And it flew incredibly well. He used no modern materials whatsoever, used only local native materials, and was able to fly his balloon to about several hundred feet, about 300 or 400 feet, and from that vantage point, all of these great drawings on the desert floor, which are otherwise completely indistinguishable from the landscape at ground level, came into perfect perspective. So, it's conceivable that the ancients actually mastered flight, and that's the core of my article about the ancient Andes.
Well, I would have to say that saying that they use a hot air balloon to view these drawings is a lot less radical than saying they were drawings done for ancient astronauts.
Well, of course, that's an old ridiculous story. I mean, there's no need to go to actually explain the greatness of our people. We don't have to go to that extreme. All of the animals that are portrayed, interestingly enough, on the desert floor at Nazca have one thing in common. They all refer to water. Now, even the spider, the spider that's portrayed has one long appendage sticking out from one of its legs and has a hook on the end of its appendage. This is a jungle spider which uses that appendage to collect dew and to drink from it. The other animals that are portrayed, like the frigate bird, is a bird that dives into the water and fills its mouth, its pouch, with water. The whale is an obvious association with water. The lizard is another animal which drinks from the dew on its legs. And this is because this is an interpretation, admittedly, but we do know that the Nazca Desert was not always a desert. that thousands of years ago was a very rich valley, and that over time it began to lose its battle with the desert, and the desert began to encroach slowly but inexorably on the livable area, the organic area. And so the people that lived there, the Nazcans, or the pre-Inca people that lived there more than 2,000 years ago, they may have been appealing through these symbols to those deities that represented water, to bring water and moisture to their homeland. And it's conceivable that the elite, perhaps, or the high priests used these arrow staffs in which to view animals that were portrayed on the desert floor. But the fact remains that a society that was as advanced, highly advanced as the Incas were, and the pre-Inca people known as the Nazca were also highly advanced. They were tremendous at building aquifers. In other words, collections for water, beautiful pottery work, magnificent high art. And they might have also had the ability to achieve man flight. And it's utterly conceivable that, in fact, that they did. And Jim Woodman's experiment with his successful hot air balloon based on the native aerostats, and the same aerostat that flew successfully for Father Guzman in 1750 in Lisbon, shows that it's at least possible that the ancients did, in fact, master man flight thousands of years before the Montgolfier brothers had their tethered balloon take off.
Oh, that's really, really interesting. I'm afraid that we could talk for hours and hours and hours and never even come close to even a small percentage of your knowledge. So before we get any further into the program, I did want to talk about the last couple of books that you've put out. Your most recent one is?
Most recent one is Atlantis in 2012. And the reason why I combine these two apparently opposite concepts is because they do reflect on each other. Now, the book is primarily, at least the first part anyway, is about the Mayan calendar and its famous prophecy, that something is going to happen, that the calendar is supposed to end, and by implication the world is supposed to end. The morning of the winter solstice, 2012. In other words, just a little more than a year from now.
Mm-hmm.
So there are numerous books out there about 2012 and what's supposed to happen. And I've read a lot of them, and they're all good. I think they all have something to offer. They're all pretty well researched. I wouldn't criticize any of them. However, their conclusions all seem to be so different from one another. Some said, this will in fact be the end of the world. The world will be incinerated by the sun. Another book says, no, this will be the beginning of a golden age. There'll be no more war or want or hatreds. That the world will become one great utopia forever and ever. And everything in between. So, what I did, I looked at the Mayan calendar, and I wanted to see what did the Maya themselves really say about 2012. Not putting our own fears on it, or putting our own expectations, our own point of view, but what did the Maya, who made this calendar, really say about the prophecy, supposedly, for next year of the winter solstice? And I found out that what the Maya said really didn't have much to say with, it didn't gel so much with what all these books were talking about. I found out that the Maya calendar, first of all, who were the Maya? The Maya were a highly civilized people who lived in an incredibly inhospitable area of Middle America, in Yucatan, in the jungle. I visited over the past numerous Maya cities and ruins, and it's amazing that they could have carved out these great, beautiful limestone, gleaming limestone metropolises out of the jungle. And they flourished from, about 400 B.C. to about 900 A.D. So they lasted a long time. Exactly why they came into being, nobody knows why their civilization stopped. But I do have kind of a clue. The Maya were a people that were obsessed with time. That was their chief god. They had many gods and goddesses, but they had one overall god. That was the god of time. The reason why they worshiped time was because time brings everything into existence. It destroys everything, and it brings everything back again. So it'll be a good thing to worship. And they developed something that they had already received from a previous people. This is what the Maya say now. The Maya say in a book of theirs, it's called the Book of Counsel, called the Popol Vuh, V-U-H. And it is a well-preserved document which explains their cosmology and their beliefs. And the Maya developed, they did not invent, but they developed a calendar. And this calendar ruled their lives because time ruled their lives. You could not go on a trip. You could not be married. You could not connect business deals, nothing, unless you did it by this calendar. So they were kind of astrologers in a way, in which astrology ruled their personal lives and the life of their civilization. And this calendar, put it, told of a time when their ancestors did not have this calendar, that their ancestors were very primitive. This is what the Popol Vuh says. And that one day there was the appearance on their shores of Yucatan, somebody called the Feathered Serpent. They called him Kukul Khan. And Feathered Serpent is a title. That was his name. And he appeared in a great ship, accompanied by a fleet of other ships. And in these ships were his friends and families. They were all sorcerers and people that were very powerful. And they had come from a land that had suffered a major flood, had gone under the sea. They were flood survivors, deluge survivors. And they brought with them the technology of their high kingdom, which no longer existed. And the Feathered Serpent was a very beneficent culture bearer. And he shared his technology with the ancestors of the Maya. And amongst that technology was this so-called calendar. Now, their calendar wasn't something like you hang on the wall to see what it is. In effect, it was an almanac, like a farmer's almanac, which tells you what's going to happen, what's going to be the best time to sow your crops, what's the best time to do this and that. So it's an almanac. That's really what the Maya calendar is. And the Maya calendar is something that the Maya developed, but they inherited from the Feathered Serpent. Now, the parallels between Kukul Khan's story and Plato's story of Atlantis are so close that I was able to see that, yes, in fact, the Maya calendar, it was something that was developed in this other previous civilization, which the Maya then took on as their own. But what does the Maya calendar say in a nutshell? I mean, we don't have time to go through this complex system that they have. The Maya say this about their calendar. That yes, that with the sunrise of the winter solstice, the calendar, the almanac, whatever you want to call it, will come to an end. There'll be no more days to check. What is going to happen, they say, is that Bolon Yacht and his nine servants from hell will descend on the earth from out of the sun. Who's Bolon Yacht? Bolon Yacht is the Maya equivalent of Satan, the worst demon you can imagine, and that his nine servants represent all of the worst calamities that could possibly happen. And they say that is what's going to happen, beginning on the sunrise of the winter solstice.
I bet the apocalyptic crowd will love to hear that.
Yeah. This isn't my interpretation. You can go and read the Popol Vuh for yourself, and you'll have all this explained to you. The most recent translation of this was found very recently, just within, I think, the last 5 or 7 years, in a place called Tortuguera. Tortuguera is this little Maya shrine, a little town that has a shrine in it. And on there, there is a direct quote in the Maya hieroglyphs, which are now thoroughly understood, and you can read them now. They're translatable. And it talks about how Bolognacte and his knights from out of the sun will purge the earth. That's it. The reason why they would say this is because humanity goes through periods of natural catastrophes. That's what their calendar was based on.
Mm-hmm.
Their calendar began in the equivalent of our year of 3114 BC. And they say at that time there was a world flood. This is what Kukulcan Khan and his followers survived, came from. And before that, there were three other natural catastrophes of a global magnitude. One was referred to as the fire from heaven. The one before that was referred to as a great wind that swept around the world. And then the earliest one is where animals, gigantic animals, attacked human beings. And at each one of these natural catastrophes, the human population was reduced to a few people. And the reason why these things happened was because human beings became so out of sync with natural law, that natural law fired back at them, as it were. And human beings always survived, a few survived, and were very penitent, promised they would never do it again. They built, rebuilt their civilization. They prospered.
They did it again. They got it destroyed.
That's right. And then they became so self-powerful that they felt they could do without living according to natural law. And then over time, nature became intolerant and backfired on. Well, anyway, they say that this will be known, this apocalypse that's going to take place, as the end of the fifth sun. What they mean by sun is a great epoch, a great era, a period of time. That's what they mean by sun. And they don't talk about any sun afterwards. This is it. The only hope they hold out, the only hope that the Maya held out, was they believed that human behavior as a whole, as a species, not just individual, but human behavior as a species, as a whole, is inextricably linked with natural phenomena. They actually believe that. And that if you, as a society, if your society is out of sync with nature, nature will rebound and will destroy you. But if you live within natural law, then natural law will you to support your civilization, and you will go on. The Maya would have told us today, I'm putting this, oversimplifying this, but the Maya would say that this great catastrophe that's going to happen, the end of time, this could be the end of humanity. They really say this could be the end of mankind beginning at this time. But the only hope could be that human beings might still get their act together and return to natural law, and they would avoid whatever would otherwise come to pass on the sunrise of the winter solstice in 2012. And that's what the Maya actually say. So it's not good news, you know, unless we can somehow, and maybe we are, maybe we already have, you know, human beings have great capacity for good as well as for evil. So maybe we will know how we stand, how we rate. I think, quite honestly, what taking all this into consideration and then comparing it with what's going on in our world today, I think that sunrise of the winter solstice 2012 will be looked upon, quite honestly, as a kind of a marker. I don't believe it's possible, but I don't believe that the sun is going to erupt with a solar flare or anything at that particular time. It's possible, but I wouldn't count on that. But nonetheless, I do believe that 2012 will be seen in retrospect in the future as some kind of a line that was crossed. for either for good or for ill. One reason I believe that is because the Maya made a prediction which is utterly astounding. The Maya, who no longer exist, of course, the Maya, I mean, well, some of their mixed descendants still exist, but as a culture, of course, of civilization, they don't exist, haven't existed for over 1,000 years. The Maya predicted this. They said that the winter solstice in 2012 will be accompanied by a sign in the heavens. Well, there will be a sign in the heavens. Astronomers do know that on the 21st of December, 2012, an event will take place which probably has never taken place before. And that is in which the galactic ecliptic will cross with the solar ecliptic. In other words, the path of the sun will form a cross, as it were, with the path of our own galaxy over something called the Dark Rift. The Dark Rift, we don't know exactly what it is. It's near the center of our own galaxy. And what's interesting about that is that this phenomena will be seen from the Earth, cannot be seen from any place else, and there's nothing significant in itself, nothing will happen, but nonetheless, it is an alignment that will take place on the 21st of December 2012, and it is out of that dark rift, or the sun, that Bolan Yakhte and his 9 servants from hell are supposed to arrive on Earth. So I'm looking around, I think, well, what could Bolan Yakhte be a symbol for? And one of the things that I learned, and you can, anybody can do this on the internet, research on the internet, is that the sun is presently going, our sun right now is presently going through a very inactive phase. An inactive phase meaning that it has no sunspots.
Right.
Sunspots are not spots. They are storms of incredible magnitude. About the size of Jupiter, in other words, about 300 or 400 times the size of Earth, and that these sunspots shoot out incredible amounts of electromagnetic material. And these flares in themselves, they can't, the sun is 93 million miles away, we're free from that. However, they can produce outbursts of electromagnetic material that could effectively fry our civilization. And that if a powerful enough electromagnetic pulse surge were to take place, all our computers would be fried. Our avionics and our aircraft would be wiped out. You wouldn't even be able to flush the toilet in your apartment because it depends on electricity. All our grid system across the entire Western world would be fried. And in fact, this has happened before. It's known to scientists as the Carrington effect. It's named after in 1851, where there was a major surge of the solar activity, a solar storm, that completely fried all of the telegraph wires across North America, the United States, Canada, and Europe. And it was known as the Carrington event, after Richard Carrington, the scientist who determined that that's what caused this great outage. And these outages take place irregularly. The last one took place in 1989 when it completely extinguished all power in Quebec. That was a small Carrington event. And astronomers are telling us that we can expect a possibility of a certainly large solar activity in 2012, coincidentally. So is that what the Maya were foreseeing? Are they foreseeing a major solar event? We live under the possibility that a Carrington event, if a Carrington event took place today, of the magnitude of the one that happened in 1851, our computers would be gone, you would not be able to start your car, aircraft would fall out of the sky, our entire civilization is built on electricity, especially electrical-run computers. Our entire
Cars wouldn't even run. Most of us have cars with computers. Unless you've got a car from, like, pre-1980 or something thereabout, your car's not going
to
run.
Even you're not going to be able to even pump gas. There won't be able to be a way to pump gas from your car. Now, what's so interesting, this is not theory. This is not speculation. Because only last year, January of 2010, NASA sent up the most expensive satellite in history. It's called the Solar Probe. And its chief purpose, you go on the NASA website, you can see this yourself, the chief purpose of that solar probe being launched only a year ago last January was to monitor the sun as an alarm, as an early warning system against a potential Carrington event. That's why that's up there. Now, that doesn't mean that that will save us, because let's say there is a major solar storm that takes place on the sun. I don't care, 2012 or any time. Okay, the solar probe, we know that it's coming. What happens then is that NASA has a direct line to our president and says, Mr. President, we have a solar storm on the way. We have anywhere from, say, 70 to 90 hours at the most, probably a lot less than that, to completely shut down the electrical grid of the United States. You have to order the electrical grid of the United States temporarily shut down. If you don't do that, and this solar storm hits us, we're going to be fried. And the general consensus is that it may be as long as 12 years in order to restore total power in the United States. But
well,
if it does shut it down, can you imagine economic consequences of shutting down all the electricity in the United States?
When you think about it, okay, when all the vehicles have been fried, our infrastructure is completely crashed. That means that food and supplies are not being moved. Most cities within 3 days are going to be completely out of food.
You bet.
Completely
consider
out.
Consider this. We have in this country, according to the FBI Uniform Crime Reports, we have in the United States a minimum 90,000 gang members across the United States. 90,000. To give you an idea how much that is, the German army, the German 6th Army that surrendered at Stalingrad, which was the most powerful army in the Wehrmacht, had 90,000 men. That's what we have in the United States. Now, what happens when you don't have law enforcement unable to use their automobiles? Because when their reserves of gas go out, they can't use their cars. The very first people that are going to die, however, are going to be the people that depend on insulin. Because the insulin has to be refrigerated constantly. Hospitals have emergency power at most for 3 days. At most. Most of them have a lot less than that time. After 3 days, all the refrigeration is going down. So it's interesting that not only are these solar flares possible, they are expecting them in the year 2012 and 2013. That's when they're expecting a lot. Every time the sun goes blank, the way our sun is blank now, that means the sun is gearing up for massive sunspot activity. Now, when these sunspots erupt, they go in every which direction. But if they don't always come here. It's conceivable that if one does come here, the effects would be really rough. And it's known as a Carrington. If a Carrington event happened today, for example, in 1851, when that Carrington event happened, you had telegraph wires that caught, telegraph systems that caught fire, offices that caught fire. You had people that were injured. You had people in Sweden that were injured by it. The next one that took place was, I think, in 1920 or 1922, a much smaller Carrington event. It completely shut down all railway traffic in New York City. It was restored pretty quickly, but nonetheless. These Carrington events were not catastrophic in the past because our civilization was not based on electricity the way it is based now.
Well, I'm thinking it was only about 10 years ago, the western portion of the United States, a huge chunk of it, and in parts of Canada, their electrical grid shut down due to a relatively small solar storm.
Yeah, relatively small one. Now, another one will definitely take place. Will definitely take place. They don't know when. But that is why the solar probe was launched. Now, in launching that solar probe, perhaps that's an indication that humanity is getting its act together. Because that solar probe is up there because of you and me and all of our listeners. We are all taxpayers. We paid to get that solar probe up there. The genius, the intelligence, the hard work of all of the people involved in getting that up there is an accumulation, is the idealization of our society. We always talk about, we talked earlier about the downside of our civilization, but the high side of it is our great science, and we paid for it. It's up there. It's monitoring it. So perhaps when this great solar, when Bolan Yochte and his nine demons come out of the sun, perhaps we'll avoid that because of our level of civilization has reached the point where we did put a solar probe up there. So that's why 2012 can go one way or the other. It can mean, yeah, we're all going to we're all going to get fried in that, or our society is going to get fried. A solar flare will not hurt you at all. Physically, will not bother people at all. But it will bother anything that's electrical in the northern hemisphere. Even if the United States escaped a solar probe, you can be sure that China and Europe and Russia will not escape it. And what would have economies of China, Russia, and Europe collapse? Will we be able to stand on our own? No way, because now we're plugged in globally. We can't stand on our own 2 feet. This is the global society that people have urged for so long. Now we're connected. So even if we escaped it, the worst effect, sure, it would drag us down economically. So, but it's interesting.
Well, at least right now we don't have that much further to go before we hit the bottom.
That's right. Something like that would totally put us over the edge. What's interesting, Gia, is that if you look at all the possibilities for a catastrophe in 2012, you know, a meteor collision, as some people have suggested, or a solar flare, or AIDS epidemic, all these other things that have been discussed, none of them are really very persuasive or convincing. Sure, it can all happen, but it's unlikely in 2012. However, a solar flare, of a solar storm of that magnitude, a Carrington event, oh yeah, absolutely. It's very possible. And obviously NASA believes that. Otherwise they wouldn't have spent I don't know how many billions of dollars to get that side of our money to get the solar probe up there. We didn't have really a solar probe before. We had a couple of very old, elderly, and inefficient satellites that were monitoring the sun that could not really give us warning. Now the solar probe can. So from a moral point of view, from a Maya point of view, have we reached the point where we are become better than we were? Or I think 2012 may make us think about these things.
Yeah, it's definitely going to make us think about a lot of things. Now, we still have a few minutes, and you had another book. You have many books that are out. You had another book that we wanted to make sure that we mentioned. Do you want to tell the audience a little bit about it?
Well, it's the most recent one. That certainly is not as catastrophic as this. It's called Gods of the Runes. And I sent you a couple of the illustrations that were done by this wonderful artist in England. And the Gods of the Runes talk about how the rune systems that are very popular today are based on the actual deities, gods and goddesses that were worshipped by the Norse. And that's what makes the runes, I think, come alive now. You can personalize them. That's the main thrust of this book, is associating each one of the runes with a specific Norse deity, either a god or a goddess. And it seems to work that well.
Well, runes are something that seem to fascinate people. And I believe some people use them for fortune telling too, don't they?
Not fortune telling. If they do for fortune telling, they're not used properly. I think what they're used for they seem to be human archetypes that can tell things about, they'll put us in touch, I think, with the spiritual side of life. But I don't think they're used for fortune telling. I never use them for fortune telling. They're not meant to be used for fortune telling. They're meant, I think, to be, they're spiritual tools, as it were, to grace the soul's, or the subconscious mind, I think. I think they have a real definite archetypal link with the subconscious mind. One more thing, reason why I mentioned Atlantis in 2012 is because not only did the Maya calendar apparently come from Atlantis, but also Atlantis was a place that was totally destroyed. A very modern society, very similar to America in many regards. And so there is definitely a parallel there. Are we going to go the way of Atlantis? Or are we going to continue on, only in the better form?
Well, you know, a lot of people get so excited about the end of the world. And I happen to be a person, I advocate emergency preparedness. I live on the Gulf Coast in Mississippi. Obviously, this is a place that has felt the hand of Mother Nature more than once.
Yep.
And you know, so being prepared for an emergency, whatever it may be, because each area has its own risks. I've had many families tell me, oh, you should move away from there because of the hurricanes. And I was like, you know, I get a 3-day warning. It's coming. I can choose to leave or stay depending on circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
I said, how much warning do people get for earthquakes, tornadoes,
right,
blizzards, so forth and so on? You know, actually, 3-day warning is pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, well, I've lived in Tornado Alley. I grew up in along the Iowa-Minnesota border, and we got hit regularly.
Oh, you have really horrific tornadoes in that area.
Yeah, and, you know, not to say that the South doesn't get them, too. Here on the Gulf Coast, they're usually, compared to the ones that I remember from my childhood, they're baby tornadoes. They still do a fair amount of damage, and yes, they can kill people, but not going to take out a quarter mile at a time.
But it is interesting that perhaps nature does seem to be getting pretty rough with us, and at the same time, maybe there is some kind of a reflection between the disintegration of human society and the deterioration of our climate. There does seem to be some kind of a parallel going on there. So maybe the Maya were not as far off.
As it sounds initially. Well, you know, when you look at tsunamis that we've had in the last decade, earthquake devastation we've had.
Yep.
People caught talking the New Madrid Fault, way overdue, like it was overdue. When it goes, it's supposed to go really hard and heavy, and now it's got a lot of people who live in that.
The scary thing about it is, as you mentioned, the economy is so fragile right now that a major natural catastrophe, which we might be able to weather relatively easily in the past, would push us over the edge. I mean, there was a major earthquake in 1959 that Alaska suffered, and the economy was strong and everything was strong, so we bounced back from that as hard as that was. But something similar to that now, like you said, the New Madrid Fault going off in southern Illinois, devastating St. Louis, for example.
Well, it'd be St. Louis and Memphis, too, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
Even Chicago.
But the main worry right now is this Carrington event from a solar flare, a solar storm, that could cause us immense difficulty. It would be very difficult to come back from. And I think its correlation with 2012 is really quite eerie. So that's the only claim I think I can make in my book, is I make the parallel between the Maya prophecy for 2012, which is not good. What the Maya had to say about 2012 is really bad. It's really not happy at all. But there is that parallel between what they said and the possibility of a Carrington event taking place in 2012 or especially 2013. It's very interesting. And pause for thought, I think.
You know, even when you start thinking about a potential 1-2 punch from Mother Nature, you know, solar flares would be devastating, a hurricane to the East Coast and an earthquake to the West Coast, which is not inconceivable to occur in the same year.
Well, look at Japan. What Japan went through with its tsunami, it is staggering. It still has not come back. Japan is still, a devastated country. You know, and
dealing with radioactive issues as well.
Well, it's just one thing after another. But our society maybe has strayed too far from the law. That's what I think the Maya would say, that we have just strayed too far from those same forces that have brought us into existence, that we've become too self-indulgent, and we've really lost our sense of humanity to some regards. And yet we still have very positive aspects to our society, like the solar probe, I think it's the Hubble Space Telescope. These are incredible achievements. The telescope, the Hubble Space Telescope shows us vistas that were beyond our imagining. So we have both the good and the bad. And I think 2012 is important because it's making people think about these issues now.
Yeah.
I believe, like I said, I think that 2012 will be regarded as a kind of a demarcation zone. I think in the future, if I'm not mistaken, we will look back on 2012 as saying that, yeah, there was some kind of a parallel with what's going on here.
Definitely. Well, we are running out of time. Folks, if you would like to check out Frank Joseph's books, if you go to exogenynetwork.com, click on Frank Joseph's name on the left-hand column, it'll take you to a page with his biography, a little picture of him, the illustrations we just talked about. And on the right-hand side, there's a thing there that's got the books that he's got with Amazon. Click on that and find those books. There's also a link there that takes you to where you can get an audio book. You actually read, which book is it?
Oh, the audio book? Oh, yeah, it's called Alien Revelation 2012. It's a novel, but it's based on real experiences. And that's www.mysticvalleymedia.com, and I narrate that. That's my first novel.
And the link is right there on the webpage, too. And, Frank, I want to thank you very much for being our guest tonight. It has been absolutely fantastic.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Gia, for letting me on, and especially for the beautiful webpage that you set up. I'm very grateful for that. You did an excellent job. I'm very grateful.
Well, thank you. And, folks, I hope you all will check it out and see what all's there. I hope everyone has enjoyed the program as much as I have tonight and that it provided you all with plenty of food for thought and more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next Tuesday as we'll bring you along for another episode of The Dawn of Shades, and I know it's going to be another fascinating conversation as well. With that, we are out of time. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.